The views and opinions of shows on KCNR are those of the hosts, guests, and callers only, and do not necessarily reflect those of the staff, management, or advertisers of KCNR Radio.
Good morning, Northern California. This is not Kevin Fry trying his best with an English accent. Kevin is actually coaching fifth graders this morning, so my name is Nigel. I'm sitting in for him, but don't worry, fully trained, fully briefed. You can catch my radio show here with James Mazzotta on Wednesday evenings from 6 to 7. So today I am filling in for Kevin Cry, and I'm actually pretty excited about this one because I think this is going to be a great show. We have with us a young man named Justin. Hello, Justin.
Hey, how's it going?
And we just met, but I can already tell he has an amazing story. And I think we're in interesting times where I think we can all use a little bit of inspiration and courage, right? I'm seeing that word there. That's pretty interesting. So, Justin, why don't you say hello to Northern California?
Hey, guys. Great to be here. Great
and,
to be here
with you. Why don't you tell us a little bit about your story?
Well,
are you from here?
I'm not. I'm from Central Cal. I'm down Hanford, Lemoore, Fresno area. Moved up here 4 years ago to kind of expand our programs up here in Northern Cal. We've done a lot with suicidal vets, homeless vets, things like that, and decided to open up into a new area.
So your area is obviously veterans. Well, let's go back to you.
All right.
So
yeah,
you were born in Central California.
Yes, sir. Yeah.
And how did you end up getting into the military?
Well, you know, I was ended up just having kind of a rough childhood, as a lot of people do. My mom was ran over by a Frito-Lay truck when I was six. And
your mom was run over by a Frito-Lay truck?
Yes, sir. She was parked at a red light, and a semi just whammed through the red light. He was drinking and left her paralyzed, brain dead, and didn't know who I was for the rest of my life. And so, yeah, when I was ended up being out of the house super early and when...
Causing trouble?
A little bit, yeah, you know.
No Frito-Lay for you.
No. when you don't have parents sitting there telling you what to do and how to do it, you kind of do what you want to do. Mm. And so when I was 18, the natural fit for me was the military. It's just what worked. And besides that, I remember sitting there seeing my granddad on the 4th of July. I have to put a pillow over his head and tell me what it was like to be in the military and what it was like to serve in that brotherhood. But what I really saw was how the patriotism of a man that was wounded in war, carrying the price of freedom on his shoulders, still carried that baggage, but it was all okay because he was part of the brotherhood, and I wanted that. And I picked that up out of the stories. And so when I was 18 or, you know, close to 18, I said, that's it, I'm going in. And I ended up getting out on a hardship early because my grandpa passed away. 2 weeks later, my grandma passed away. 2 weeks later, my sister passed away. Oh. And I was negative like 30-some days leave, and we were deploying to Bosnia, and I was... punching walls and breaking fists and going AWOL. And, you know, the military was like, look, you've been a great soldier for us. Take some time, clean up, and come back when you're ready. Well, went out and it wasn't, you know, I went out and got a good paying job right away thanks to the military service. And it wasn't long till 9/11 happened. And I sit there and watch those towers fall over and over and over for 3 days and jumped up and went down and signed back up and went over, ended up in the Battle of Fallujah, ended up leaving a leg behind over there, took a bullet through the center of both knees, an AK-47 round, and that's when life got interesting.
Well, so that's called going into the deep end, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you signed up, and how long before you ended up in Fallujah?
About a year and a half.
Because I think we've all heard of, well, those of us old enough anyway, we've heard about Fallujah. So you were in the quote unquote Battle of Fallujah?
Yes, sir. Yeah. We ended up, I was supposed to go to Afghanistan and they kept, activating us and then deactivating us about a dozen times. And you're treated like a yo-yo out there. I had ran down just to the guard unit that was deploying, signed up with them and said, hey, you guys need help, let's go, you know? And so they would actually get us in the air even. We would be on the way over and then turn us around and send us back and deactivate us. And so all these guys, all these men and women that were doctors and truck drivers and whatever, a lot of crutches.
You get hyped up.
Yeah, that way, and you got to leave your job and your family, and you're going over for 16 months, and then all of a sudden, nope, sorry, go back to work. And you're like, you got to turn that militaristic light switch off and go back. And, you know, when you do this a dozen times, pretty soon you're giving the military the bird. Like, I can't keep doing this. Mm-hmm. Except those of us that joined, you know, that were really just put everything on hold and like, no, I'm going over. And, but, so that was an interesting time.
So, as a guy, do you end up with, so there's the military mission, and then there's your own personal mission. Like, were you on a, did you have your own personal mission to get into this and to become a soldier and something larger than yourself?
Yeah, you know, from the first time, I always felt guilty that I went in and got all this training, and I didn't even finished my 4 years the first time, you know. And I remember I'd go and I'd sit there at an event and they would say, you know, can all the veterans please stand? And I wouldn't stand. I didn't feel like I earned that title. I didn't even finish my first tour after all. But and once I saw the towers fall, it's personal. My mission now was personal. Mm-hmm. You don't come and sucker punch us, you know. And to follow in the footsteps of the Vietnam vets that were sped up on and hated, and the World War II vets, you know, these generations that carried us to where we are today, it was my duty.
So I was always curious about this. So you go over to Iraq, and it's one of those things that when you land and you get off the plane that you immediately know that you're somewhere far, far away, and
yeah.
It's a strange vibe.
You know, it was interesting. Kuwait is what got me. When we hit Kuwait, we were there for 10 days, and luckily I was going advance party from Kuwait. I was the first one into Iraq for our group. Kuwait sucked. I mean, it sucked. The smell, the cooking, the oils, it was just so different. The whole time in Kuwait, I'm like, man, I don't know if I could do this. This is miserable. You know, the sandstorms at 3 o'clock every day. When I hit Iraq, you know, it was so much better. I don't know what it was. It was just so much better. Even though we were getting into firefights right away, I'd rather have that than sitting back at Kuwait.
Tell us about your first firefight.
Well, you know, it wasn't even much of a firefight, really, but they said, hey, we're, well, first the combat landing in Iraq, that was interesting. We get in the plane to leave Kuwait, and there's like five or six of us doing an advance party, and we're coming in, and the guys are sitting at the windows with guns. I'm like, what are you sitting at a window with a gun in a plane for, you know, and full body armor, and they're like, yeah, relax, you know, won't be a long flight. And I remember looking out the window, and it seemed peaceful down there. Like, tractors in the fields and trees. And then pretty soon, they're like, guys with radios at the windows calling in people that are going to, you know, firing at us from below, which, you know, I didn't realize that yet. And all of a sudden, the plane starts doing a combat landing. And it's just climbing real high and dropping and banking. And I'm all of a sudden strapping in and putting on my Kevlar. I'm like, what is going on? And pretty soon we land. And they're like, get off the plane. Go, 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 go. And we jump off around. And I'm looking. And the pilots jump off. And they start putting circles on the plane. I'm like, what's going on? He's like, these are the fresh bullets. What? They're shooting at us already? And so that was really the first, but you know, we have the enemy back far enough that they're not able to do much damage to our planes, but they're still doing it.
Yeah. Okay. So let's fast forward to the Battle of Fallujah. If you're comfortable talking about that,
yeah,
tell us no about problem. That. Tell us about how that transpired.
Well, it was, you know, interesting. The guys that were there for the year, the first year, they were bored. They're like, yeah, no action. We're not getting into firefights. We're just bored stiff. They just wanted to go home. And, you know, we're all coming in. We're hyped up, ready, finger on the trigger almost. You know, we're ready for battle. And they're like, don't, you're not going to see any firefights. You're not going to see anything. Then, but right off the bat, it was different. And one of the issues is you've got, say, 300,000, 400,000 guys there. Now all of a sudden we come in to replace them. So now we're coming in with another 300,000 or 400,000. And so now you've got, you know, 600,000, 700,000, 800,000 guys, and they're training us for 2 weeks. So we're all over the place. And the enemy's like, wow, look at all the targets. And so they just started hammering us during that time period. And, you know, and those guys are like, oh man, the bullets are flying. What's going on? We, you know, I just want to go home now. These guys come and everybody's under attack. And so we went through a period of that, and I was actually only in combat 2.5 months, but it was enough to get shot at a few times, get mortared a bunch of times, and, you know, things like that. It was the 1 year anniversary of toppling Saddam's army. It was Good Friday, April 9th, 2004, and we were about to take over Fallujah. We had been spending the last 3 days prepping for it. It's about the size of Fresno, which is the fifth largest city in California. It's pretty big, you know. There's Fallujah population's like well over 1 million. It's a pretty good size place, and we put up a K-rails. Concrete barriers are a mile outside of Fallujah around the whole city. That's a lot of
K-rails. That's a big project.
Oh, a huge project, yeah. The engineers going forever on this project. And then we dropped in the leaflets and said, you can come in, but you can't, you can go out, but you can't come in. Because we're going to come in and go door to door. We're going to take over this city. We own Iraq, basically. But this is the stronghold of the insurgents. And they own that. And we did not know what was going to happen. I mean, we thought we had it, but no, we basically stirred the hornet's nest is what we did. They had bedded down in there. The houses were all booby trapped. And for 3 days though, we did a little mini shock and awe. We're dropping bombs. Helicopters are bombing it. We're taking over their strongholds that we think. But they just bedded down. And so when the Marines started going in door to door, I remember it was the shock and awe still going on. And, you know, we haven't started going in. And my convoy, I was usually escorting a general and a colonel or something, or a gunner bringing in supplies somewhere. I was on a gun truck usually. And on this mission, it was still, the Battle of Fallujah hadn't started quite yet, and they sent us in to pick up a load, and it said 762 all down the sides of these crates. I'm like, 762? What are we bringing the enemy's ammo into the Battle of Fallujah for? You know, conspiracy theories start flowing, and then they're like, well, these are your trucks, and then you've got another set of trucks over here. We're like, well, we were only told these six. And what we were doing is we were bringing in 3.5 million rounds of AK-47 rounds and three trucks full of AK-47s because the enemy's flak vest would stop the M-16 round, but it wouldn't stop the AK-47 round. So we were passing out AK-47s to the Marines that we had confiscated. So that was kind of cool. But Marines were loving it too, man. And it's Christmas. We're bringing in AK-47s to them. They're loving it. And so right off the bat, we're switching from daytime operations to nighttime operations. And I'm going to tell you, we're in these PLSs. They go like 60 miles an hour, balls to the wall. They're flat out. 60 is the top. And it's like...
I can see on your face that you're kind of an adrenaline junkie.
Oh, it's awesome. Yeah. Here you are bringing in 3.5 million rounds. It's like taking in a load of drugs downtown L.A. on this truck that just doesn't go very fast and is loud and bulky. And everybody wants what you have.
Mm.
And so we're, you know, you don't stop in anywhere. If somebody gets in your way, you run them over. And so you're coming in through Baghdad and through all these areas, and everybody sees what you have. We're not hiding it. We're bringing it in. And so we're, you know, people are running. It went from a parade of everybody waving to you like, oh, we need to attack this convoy. And we got the first load in, usually day operation. Now it's 2 o'clock in the morning. We put a surprise on and we pulled up. The Marines had a big ramp to come and get this ammo off our trucks and stuff. And pretty soon you heard a whistle. The first mortar's on its way in after us. And so there's three of us standing. This PLS is, the wheels are like 10 feet tall, you know, and then you're three pallets on top of that. We're way up there. And because of the embankment, we're 30 feet in the air from the far side.
So you're slightly visible.
Very visible. The first mortar hit it was way off. It was probably close to 100 yards behind us. But it was such a beautiful display of glowing shrapnel. I mean, it truly looked like a firework. It just made me stop and like, wow. But then the three of us knew they're going to walk them in. And we're standing on all this ammo. We're like, we're going to have to jump. But mm-hmm. It's way down. And I was going to grab onto a strap and jump down, holding onto that strap. I mean, I've got grenade strapped mm-hmm. to my chest, and I'm carrying the saw, the squad automatic weapon. It's 13 pounds. I've got like 70 pounds of gear on me. And as I went to jump, the next mortar hit, and it blew me about 30 yards out, and it you know, knocked me out. They didn't walk any more in, which is unusual. Usually they'll walk it in until they hit the target. They could see us because it's nighttime operation, and the Marine left the forklift lights on. It's just shining on us. And we're about a mile outside Fallujah watching the little mini shock and awes. Here we are all lit up like a Christmas tree. But they didn't walk any more in. We got all that finished up. Had to go find the Marine that took off running. God bless him. He took off, man. But we got everything done with that. And we reloaded, and now it's April 9th, 2004, Good Friday. And we had left Balad, a big hospital, military base, loaded up with some more stuff. And it's kind of a peaceful day out. There's not a lot happening, but we know it's coming. And as we were loaded up and we came around the corner out of Baghdad to turn to head to Fallujah, it's just a peaceful early morning, and all we could see was mushroom clouds start going up everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
We're climbing on this huge 6-lane freeway, and there's a convoy in front of us that doesn't have gun trucks. They were supposed to wait for us, and they took off, and it was Thomas Hamill's convoy. It was a KBR civilian that was... had a bunch of military with him, but as we came up, we saw in front of us then just smoke and mushroom clouds, and we were like, ah, crap. They're getting hammered, and we cannot turn around. There's no way. These trucks take a country mile to turn around, and they don't have much help in front of them, but this is not pretty. As we rolled up, we could see all their fuel trucks were on fire. We were literally just seeing bodies slumped over the steering wheel. And I look out on the right, and there's no bullets flying, but I see Thomas Hamill, who had been sleeping on the runway next to us the night before. He's a KBR civilian. They had a gun resting on his shoulder, and they're walking backwards. They had captured him. You know, the next thing I heard was a bullet, and I looked at my driver. I'm like, they hit our truck. And then I saw him get hit in the shoulder, and then I didn't even realize. My feet felt wet. And that bullet that hit our truck had went through the center of both of my knees. And I didn't even know it yet. Like, I started moving my toes.
You had all the adrenaline going and you just couldn't tell.
Yeah, yeah. And it's kind of a slow motion right now. It's mm-hmm. like I hear on the radio, you know, fire from the left, not fire from the right, you know. And I mean, and I'm hearing the commands go out. And I'm just looking down at my legs going, I probably should get some pressure on the knees because blood's squirting out of both sides of both legs. The bullet went through both, actually off the engine cover and then back into the left knee. So I got shot by the same bullet three times.
That was a hint.
That's it, yeah. Yeah, you're going to run out of blood here eventually. So I'm quickly trying to wrap, get pressure on that. But now I've got to get on the saw. And the saw, because the enemy is on both sides of us. Turns out, in Thomas Hamill's book, he was captured and then escaped. In his book, it said 760 insurgents had us surrounded. That's when he was there. By the time we got done, over 1,000 insurgents had us surrounded, according to satellite images. We were pinned down. We're doing 0 to 3 miles an hour most of the time for the next 45 minutes. And three of their guys got captured right beside us. So we're doing what we can do. And the saw is my favorite weapon. I mean, it's not a high-powered weapon. It's just a 5.56, 223 round. But it can shoot, 760 rounds a minute. It shoots over 1,000 rounds a minute when it's turned up all the way. And so I'm putting some lead downrange here, trying to, just kind of maybe hold the enemy back a little bit. And I see our trucks taking mortars, RPGs. I didn't even know that our truck.
And in the meantime, both of your knees are blown out.
Yeah, they're gone. And so I'm trying to just do some pop shots because I'm going to run out of ammo quick. And this is not a pop shot, type of situation out there. Usually in a firefight, they spray a few bullets at you and they run like cowards. This one, they're coming in hard. They're going to come take our stuff, and they're not stopping. I mean, they're jumping up on running boards and pulling people out of trucks. And I already see our guys getting captured. And part of me is like, do I shoot our guys? If it was me, I would be like, shoot me. I don't want to be captured by these guys. Mm-hmm. But so I see them running up, trying to get people off the running boards or jumping up on the running boards, but we're in a big curve at this point. So I'm going to be shooting our trucks, trying to, take guys off of there. I look out, and I see two guys, maybe 15 yards, 20 yards away, and I brought my saw back, and just before I pulled the trigger, they fell. I didn't have to do anything there, but a little kid pops up. He's like 7 years old. And he pops up, and his eyes are so huge, like golf balls. He's just staring at me, 15, 20, I don't know, yards away. And he's got this AK-47 pointed at me. And I bring my saw back, and I lock it onto him, and I'm just like, I can't kill this kid. All I see is my son. And I literally just kind of, in my testimony, I stopped and I prayed for a second. It's amazing how in the heat of combat, when if you think you die, if you stop and think you die because bullets are coming from everywhere, I stopped and prayed. I was like...
At that point, time stands still.
It did. It did. And I'm just like, God, I can't do this. I said, I can't kill this kid. And without thinking, God truly took over my weapon and it sprayed around this kid. He ditched his weapon and dove into the bushes. And I'm thinking, okay, I'm about out of blood. I mean, blood's...
Okay, hold on a second. I think we're going to take our first break real quick.
Okay.
I know we're in the thick of it here. We'll be right back.
KCNR Shasta is also broadcasting at K243CT Reading.
Each year, millions of older adults suffer injuries from a fall. One out of five falls results in life-threatening injuries, such as broken bones or head trauma. Many falls are preventable. PSA2 Area Agency on Aging announces the Dignity at Home Fall Prevention Program, funded by the California Department of Aging. This no-cost program's mission is to reduce the number of debilitating falls suffered at home by older adults and persons with disabilities. If you are 60 and older, or persons with disabilities of any age residing in Lassen, Modoc, Shasta, Siskiyou, or Trinity counties and are at risk of falling or being institutionalized, this program may be able to help. The Dignity at Home Fall Prevention Program enables older adults and persons with disabilities to live independently and safely in their home environment for as long as possible. Contact PSA2 Area Agency on Aging at 842-1687. That's 842-1687 to learn more about the Dignity at Home Fall Prevention Program.
Hi, this is Brian Martin, General Manager of River Common Senior Living. One of the most rewarding things about what I do is watching the positive transformation that often occurs when a senior moves here to our beautiful, independent retirement community. Seniors can become isolated, find it hard to eat good, healthy meals, and even just get around. I call this a failure to thrive. At River Commons, we solve those challenges. You are surrounded by friendly people with similar life experiences. Chef Shalisa and her crew provide three delicious and healthy meals daily. Activities Director Ernie always has a wide variety of things to do, from arts and crafts to outings on our 25-passenger bus. Plus, we provide utilities, cable TV, scheduled transportation, weekly housekeeping, and more. We see seniors go from survive to thrive, and that is just a wonderful thing. Call today for a tour or luncheon a tour and experience River Commons for yourself. 221-2121 or on the web river-commons.com.
And we're back. This is Nigel Skeet sitting in for Kevin Cry. this is one of those shows I wish we had a few hours. We're here with Justin Bond. Veteran, lost both of your legs.
One leg. Mm-hmm.
You're describing the battle and this kid, and you stopped to pray, and why don't you bring us forward to how you ended up back here?
Yeah, during that battle, I started to reevaluate. Okay. How are we going to get out of the situation? You know, I can't control these trucks moving forward, this and that. We're going to run out of ammo. We're going to get overran. So I'm preparing to get captured. I have a go bag ready to go. I'm thinking, do I end it if I'm captured? Like, I just saw Thomas Hamill and Matt Maupin get captured. Or do I fight through this if I'm captured? And so I'm looking at my driver, and there's a doghouse in front of us. And if he goes down, I can't get over to drive. I'm not going to push him out of the truck, but there's no way I can drive from over here. And I'm starting to go in shock. He's throwing water on me. And then all of a sudden, somehow, we're out of this fight. We got guys pulling trucks in front of other trucks, hooking them, jumping out in the middle of a firefight, hooking them up to tow them out because our trucks are down. We're 10-wheel drive, 6-wheel steering. These trucks are massive, but we can shut axles off when axles get blown up. So anyway, they get us up. A Humvee pulls up, rips me out of the truck, throws me in. It's full of wounded, and they get us up to Abu Ghraib prison. Now, you've heard the stories about that place. The prisoners are there right now. I mean, we're getting, like, we're in the hospital there. They're doing surgeries on us. And I'm out of blood. And they had to grab somebody and do a direct transfusion. They literally hooked up an IV from somebody standing above me and then hooked it up to me. And I'm just like, can that happen? You know, I've got morphine on board. I'm in shock. And, you know, but nothing is real. And I remember this they're walking this prisoner through, and he turns and he spits on one of my buddies. The hatred that came over me. I wanted to jump up and kill that guy. I couldn't even move, though, but I wanted to kill. I didn't want to kill anybody the whole time I was over there. I never hated the enemy. You know, and like in Vietnam, you know, they hated the enemy because they were out there in the jungles and, you know, this and that. I never hated my enemy.
Mm-hmm.
And most of the time we were fighting the Iraqis, and they didn't want to hurt us. In fact, several firefights, they would shoot around our vehicle because they were getting paid. We would pay them $1 a day. Well, and maybe up to $100 a day. Well, the enemy would pay them $1,000 a day to attack our convoys. But they didn't want to hurt us. When the insurgents were there, that's when they had to attack the convoys. And this dude spit on my guy, and I knew he was an insurgent. He wasn't an Iraqi that was, you know, out there fighting for his own land. And anyway, I go on tangents all the time.
Yep.
I'm sorry. We'll speed it up here.
Well, pretty soon I want to get to your project here because I want to know how.
Yeah. So they did a bunch of surgeries. They started flying me. They were going to get me to Germany, but, you know, in the air, they started to lose me again, and they had to land in Balad. And this happened three times. They had to land three times and do surgeries on me. Pretty soon I was in Germany. Unbelievable experience in Germany. I was in ICU outside. The entire hospital was turned into ICU, and there were so many wounded in the Battle of Fallujah. I was told by a colonel that it was over 5,000 wounded. That never hit the media. They destroyed us in Fallujah. We lost that battle. We had to pull out and stop and then go back in several months later and take it over. And then eventually I was at Walter Reed for over a year, recovering and all that.
Okay. And then when did you come back home, California?
So the bad thing about, you know, when you go to war, you're always training for the previous war. You don't train for what you're going into. You train for what the military
yep.
knows. They didn't have medical down for us. You know, after Vietnam, the medical advanced a lot, but they were not prepared for, you know, this enemy didn't want to kill us. This enemy wanted to wound us. And with medical technology the way it was, everybody was living. I'm laying there in the hospital, a guy's missing a half a head and no arms and no legs.
But he's still alive.
Alive. And now how do you recover this guy? How do you get this guy through recovery? Well, the military said, you're still on orders for us, so either we can't retire you out until you're no longer going to get better or worse, or until you can go back to the battlefield.
I think we have a phone call.
Okay.
Nick?
Hey, good morning. I'm curious, if our fighters are a number 10, what number would the Iraqi fighters be? And on top of that, I want to ask you, do you think that our superiors were fighting that war to win it or just running a police state and la-di-da? Thank you.
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, their fighters weren't even on the scale. They really weren't. We were training them to try and fight. I called it rodeo roundup. Every time we got into a firefight, they would just run. The Iraqis that we were training, the bullets were flying, they would split out of there in a heartbeat with our equipment. The people that we were fighting, the insurgents, they are sitting a mile away and call a cell phone and it explodes something the size of a soda can and blows us up, and then they're nowhere in a 10-mile radius after that. They were not fighters. They're a bunch of cowards. As far as trying to win the war, I became friends with President Bush. I'm blessed to be able to go have dinner at his house with him and spend time with him. And he truly did want to get in and win the war. He was pissed. He really was. Congress tied his hands and tied the military's hands behind our back. Our rules of engagement did not allow us to fight that war. A quick example of that is the towers at our base at Taji, Camp Taji, which was the largest base. We had 30,000 people at our base. It was Saddam's largest base. If a car is coming by, what they would do is they would have this in the back of the truck, a tarp over it, and they would pop up and mortar straight up in front of our convoy, mortar straight up, so when our convoy is coming through, it come back down onto our convoy. Say that car is coming through. We know what's happening. We see them with, we see what's going to happen. We're not allowed to fire at that convoy from our bases. Our towers are not allowed until two towers have called in the color of the vehicle and the direction it's going.
It's crazy.
It's crazy.
So just so we don't run out of time, I want to hear about your project here.
Yeah, so after I got back and lost my 11th friend to suicide, you know, I'm sitting on the couch, not really feeling sorry for myself, a little pissed off that I'm not over on the battlefield front helping my buddies. But I'm sitting there with no mission. I'm sitting there disabled and retired out at 26 years old building model rockets, you know, building RC airplanes. And I knew that wasn't going to be for me, but I was comfortable. I had, you know, 20-some medications. The VA kept me, I call it my VA candy. It kept me very comfortable. I couldn't go to counseling because they didn't understand. And nobody understood at the VA. They always said, hey, how did you feel when this happened to you? I'm like, what happened to me? What's firefight? Which, you know, Purple Hearts or carrying battle buddies off the field, you know. And they're treating this with what PTSD is, a traumatic event. That's singular. That's a firefight. That's a crash. Well, what we have is not a traumatic event. It's a traumatic lifestyle. Now these kids are going from high school to 20 years on two war fronts, you know, a dozen tours, you know, like a police officer, which, by the way, are now treated like our Vietnam vets were, which is unacceptable. America has it wrong again. Well, I don't want to say America, a certain breed in America, which basically, not trying to get political, but, you know, they're using us as pawns, our Congress and our media. Sorry, I get in tangents all the time. And so I knew I had to have a something. Pretty soon I was able to help save one of my buddies, you know, and I thought, wow, that's a mission. That was critical. I said, pretty soon I'm talking to another one, and, you know, he's got a gun in his mouth. I'm like, all right. So long story short, Our Hero's Dreams was formed in
Our Hero's Dreams.
Our Hero's Dreams, yes, sir. And I don't even know how we came up with that name. I don't know. Pretty soon a bunch of guys started getting together, and we had a guy with no arms and no legs that was going to kill himself, you know. And I said, hey, let's go out. And so what did you used to do in life? He said, well, I used to scuba dive. I'm thinking, all right, let's go scuba diving. And I'm scared to death. I'd rather be back in firefight than go scuba dive with sharks. But we got him out there and got him certified to scuba dive again. And he started going to church, and he went on to become the national commander of the Disabled American Veterans. And I started seeing a trend here of things, and it started working. So we started doing these retreats, and we got a board together and got people that knew what they were doing in the business world. You know, this, I'm just an Army sergeant. I'm like, how are we going to raise money? I don't know. I had a Segway sitting there, so I jumped on a Segway and rode it from Monterey, California to Jacksonville, Florida. I'm like, well, that sucked. I was almost going to battle again, you know, broke my arm on day three. And it just started advancing and advancing, and I learned not to use my own judgment. And if, you know, God, I wasn't following, but he started putting C4 on the doors of which way I needed to turn and blowing off the hinges so I would go that way. And he's really just developed this into a massive program now.
And so how did you end up in Shasta County?
So we had helped a couple thousand people get off suicide watch. And if they finished the program, it was 100% successful. We did lose one. He was on meth. His name was Brian. And Brian drove me to not lose another. And so our program is constantly evolving. It's but we had a good team in Shasta. And it was truly a God thing. There was a lot going on. We looked at going to Arizona. We were going to move and open up a new section. Well, I popped 7 tires on one trip on the way to Arizona.
So that was another hint?
Another hit, man. My daughters, we're 2 weeks from signing them. They're all signed up in school. They got to be in school in 2 weeks. We've got land all picked out. And it totally reversed everything. And to be honest, I'm selfish. I wanted out of California. I was done with California. So we got a rental car. I said, let's go check out Oregon. Not that it's much better there with the politics and stuff. But I found some land up there. So we're heading up there. And we stop in Redding for the night. And this was the last place I wanted to be. It's 120,000 degrees. It's like Iraq, you know. And I didn't know anything about the area, though. And we stopped overnight. And, man, this realtor is talking at the table next to us about this piece of land. And it sounded amazing. And so, I just asked him a few questions. He's like, yeah, it's not on the market. I'm like, it sounds perfect for a camp that we've got this idea for. Long story short, they lowered the price in half, carried the loan for us. I went and talked to the county first, got all of my ducks in a row, got permission for all this stuff. That was 2019, November. Mm. COVID hit 2 months later.
Yep.
Which then you couldn't do anything in the county after that, you know, or anywhere. Then the county put up every red flag they could, shut the door on me. I'm like, it's got to be a God thing that we're here. You know, we popped all these tires. They lowered it, you know. And my last name is Bond, like James Bond. The address was 7007. The zip code was 96007. Our loan documents, when they carried it, ended in 007. My daughters are just ecstatic. They're like, Dad, this is meant to be, you know. But the county, they shut it all down. But our biggest issue is, we're an all-volunteer group for one, okay? No employees, a couple hundred volunteers. We're saving lives on $140,000 a year because that's all we need. We've got camps donated, but only part-time. If somebody called in on a suicide call right now to our hotline, I would have to be like, the next two are full, but in 3 months we can get you in. You know, can you take the gun out of your mouth for 3 months? Or to tell a child or a spouse, just hold on. We had to get land right now, a camp right now, full time. And now we're shut down through COVID. And suicides are off the charts high. And then we found this camp in the next county over. It's a mansion on 40 acres. It's going to be the largest camp in the nation. And it's a turnkey operation. It was like a $12 million camp, but we were going to be able to help so many people. We started talking to the owners. They lowered it down a couple of times, and they lowered it down to $4.3 million. And I'm an Army sergeant.
You don't have that in the bank?
Didn't have it in the bank. And I'm not going to jump on a Segway again. Mm-hmm. You know, there's got to be a better way. Now we got to raise millions, not 100,000. But in, you know, the last 4 months, 5 months that we put this out, we've raised almost $2 million.
That's awesome.
And without a campaign publicly, like the nation doesn't even know this is happening, but behind the scenes, just by talking to great Americans, you know, patriots, it's been coming through. People are like, here, I'm going to donate this house to you. Go sell it. You know, I'm going to do this. I'm going to do that. And so we have to raise $2 million more dollars.
Is there a deadline?
There's no deadline. The owners are working with us. They want us to have it. They're talking about even lowering it more.
So this is in Siskiyou?
Siskiyou County. It's on Lake Shastina, 40 acres. It's got 5 cabins. It's got 17 beds. It's a mansion with tennis courts, ponds, basketball. We have free skiing for our warriors up at Lake Shasta. We've got the lake to play on there. Not Lake Shasta, the ski park Shasta. Mm-hmm.
Ski park.
Yes, sir. And so it's amazing. And our total cost to bring a warrior through the program, that's with doctors, nurses, insurance, food, everything, is $1,623 on this location. And the few programs around the nation that do a part of what we do, our phase one and two is basically what's out there. There's other programs that do what our phase three is. Nobody's doing our phase four.
What's phase four?
Phase four is, so Phase one is getting them up off the couch, bringing them out into the brotherhood, sitting around the fire, and figuring out what's holding them on the couch. What's going to take to get you out of your mind and showing them how to turn off that militaristic light switch, but how to keep that warrior light switch on. It's huge. Phase two is now we've created a mission plan, and we're going to put on all those Band-Aids, a car repair, home repair, relationship, PTSD, whatever it is. We're going to start to put on all those Band-Aids. Phase three is now that you're starting to breathe again and you're starting to live, we're going to bring your family out and do this all over. The kids are going to do counseling with other kids that have been there, spouses with spouses, and then back as a family unit while doing some cool stuff like skydiving or scuba diving or learning to play golf or skiing. And you get to be around people like-minded. And your counselors are all people that have been there. Our counselors are not somebody that's trained by the book for PTSD. It's people that have been there. Phase four, you know, if you stop there, you send them home, you send them back to the couch. You got no mission. You got kids, you know, I got buddies 19 years old missing all four limbs. They came back. They can't be retired with no mission. So phase four is we help them find that new mission. We help them write a business plan for their new mission. And we go out into the community. You know, we built the largest toolbox in the nation, which is great. We don't want to reinvent any wheels. We want, you know, if this nonprofit's offering this and we need it, we want to partner with you.
Yep. And you mean working together? What a novel concept, right?
Yeah. Some don't understand that. But, you know, we've been able to give away 29 houses that way. We give away, you know, we just got a car donated yesterday. To give to, you know, and we've got a list of people that need vehicles that don't have vehicles. In a short order, I'll give you one example. This guy, we got a phone call from a wife, and she said, "Hey, my husband's going to kill himself. I had to leave the house with the kids. I moved to Washington." Okay, she said he hasn't left the house in 3 years or hugged and kissed me in 5 years. So I went and knocked on this guy's door. I'm like, "Yeah, you know, Sergeant Fitzpatrick, you know, hey, can you answer the door?" Wouldn't answer. Pretty soon, I said, "You know, your wife messaged me," and boom, "My wife messaged you?" I'm like, "Yeah." The smell of mold knocked me back. I was like, "Oh my gosh." The house was filled with mold. Hundreds of pizza boxes stacked along the wall. He literally is not leaving the house. He's making $7,000 a month, no mission in life, and won't leave the house, sucking on VA candy, sucking on the bottle. Long story short, bring him out, figure out what Band-Aids he needs. We tell him, the only way we get him out is we tell him your wife's going to come out too pretty soon. You know, he's sitting out there at the Brotherhood, realizes he doesn't have a mission. We show him how to turn off that militaristic light switch. We go in $96,000 in material in his home. And the community wants to support. The community wants to come out and do this. It costs us nothing. You know, we literally had nothing into this project. We put on all these Band-Aids, fix his house up, brand new furniture for the house, brand new windows, roof, paint. But if we ended there and sent him back to the couch, it doesn't fix it.
Yep.
So we ask him, "What did you used to do in life?" He said, "Well, you know, I worked all week and I love to go up and take my kids up backpacking." Great. We contacted the Forest Service in California and they said, "If he'll maintain trail, we'll put his name on it." Now he runs our Mountain Warriors program and he's got 8 trails that we're maintaining and he's bringing groups of vets and first responders up to maintain these trails, building latrines, and he has the volunteer of the year every single year for the Forest Service. His wife is like, "Man, I wish you would come home more than 3 days a week."
So this is probably an oversimplistic way of looking at it, but it sounds like to me that you're finding somebody who's lost their mission. They have no more mission, and you're building a community around them.
Yes, sir. Yeah, and you know, the recidivism rate is pretty low when you do all four phases.
Yeah.
They don't usually have to come back too often. You know, we get them into a business or whatnot. But we started doing more of spiritual retreats at times. We offer both. And what we found is, you know, when they find a higher purpose, mm-hmm. all of a sudden the recidivism rate is nothing.
Right.
And so the spiritual retreats have been working awesome. And so, and it's not that we're preaching a religion or any of that, but we were not born. We show them. We were not born to be on this earth with no mission and no purpose. When people die, it's after they retire. You know, you work your whole life.
That's a death word right there, retire.
It is. And these kids are so young. And so when all of a sudden they're sitting out there around this campfire, and the Vietnam vets that hated their war, hated what they had to go through, but now, because of what they had to go through, is directly going to save a life to somebody.
Yep.
And they correlate that. You know, we show them, okay, you have a new mission as a Vietnam vet, which most of our guys are Vietnam vets, too, coming through our program still. There's a key thing that we didn't talk about. I'm going to drop that for a second. The suicide rate, they say, is 22 a day. What America doesn't understand and know is that number for all these years has been from 21 states. Hmm. That's it. California didn't report in. Texas didn't report in, and on and on. I petitioned Congress. I fought 6 years to get that changed. This year, the VA's touting, every state's reporting in. But when you go look at it, most counties are not reporting in.
Hmm.
California had 400 suicides last year.
Well,
that's it. And, you know, and examples of that, of why they're not reporting, America can't handle the true numbers. They really can't.
Can't handle the truth, right?
Yeah. But so when I went out on my Segway right across America, the sheriff came out from Monterey County and he said, "Hey, I know what you're doing. I love it." He said, "We had a veteran pass away this morning in his house." I said, "Well, you know, what happened? It was suicide?" He goes, "Well, it was an accidental discharge while gun cleaning. If it was suicide, his family wouldn't get the insurance money, and it would look bad on his family." And that's just one example. You know, if they don't go into the VA, the numbers aren't reported.
Was it self-evident, I would say, that those suicide numbers are obviously much higher.
Secretary of Defense Leon Panetta said it's at least double. There's other reports out that it's at least double. It also doesn't count active duty as 6.8 a day or reserves at 1.3.
So we only have a few minutes left. How can people reach you? What do you need?
Yeah, so Justin Bond, like James Bond.
Justin Bond.
OurHeroesDreams.org. We have our website up. It doesn't show anything on the camp just yet. We have a brand new massive website launching next month. It doesn't work without America coming together. Congress and our country is not going to save our guys. The suicide rate is going to continue. The Army put out, we don't know what to do next with the suicide numbers. Our numbers are climbing daily in active duty. It takes a lot of great Americans to come together to support great projects, and that's what we're asking. We're just asking for, you know, we're not asking anybody to come up with $1 million because, you know, even though that would be great if a business can do it or somebody can do it, but everybody doing the little bit that they can and coming mm-hmm. together helps out tremendously. You can email me at justinbond at ourheroesdreams.org. Go to our website, ourheroesdreams.org. And 100% goes into it. We have zero overhead right now, no employees. Our board pay is comprised of Navy captains and sergeant majors and business owners, and they even cover our overhead. And so we are going to hire employees, but we started about this earlier. At the end of the day, our cost is $623, something like that, per person to go through. At the end of the day, we are going to be able to charge the VA $3,000, and the CCPOA is going to help cover for correctional officers and the Firefighter Foundation for firefighters and on and on. At the end of the day, we will have to do no fundraising for this once operational, and we will make over $1 million a year profit. That's without the $750,000 grant from the VA and things like that. So we're funded once we're operational. We just need to raise $2 million more to
That's
get
it.
Off the ground.
Well, listen, thank you for your service. We're on an amazing journey.
Appreciate it.
And this is just
thank
the beginning.
You. Bye.
Bye.
The news from Town Hall is brought to you on KCNR Shasta Reading by Shasta Regional Medical Center. Your life, your health, your choice. Shasta Regional Medical Center.